Welcome back to Talking Asset Management with KPMG and our series on private credit. Today's episode, we're going to focus on the BDCs and credit fund of funds in a RIC wrapper. So BDCs, business development companies, and RIC, regulated investment companies. So we're going to talk about these products and their popularity in recent years. And why that is, higher interest rate environment that we're in, companies looking for alternative sources of capital, and a lot of foreign investment coming into the vehicle. My name is Deirdre Fortune, and I am our national tax leader in public investment management and our global asset management lead. And joining me today, I have Colleen Anderson, who is our deputy tax leader in our public investment management practice, and Sonia Shadapuri, tax managing director in our public investment management practice. So we're looking forward to discussing this topic. It's something we live every day. So I'm going to kick it off with you, Sonia, and we use the BDC term, but what does that actually mean?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Deirdre. So business development companies, which we commonly refer to as BDCs, were created by Congress through the Small Business Investment Incentive Act of 1980. They are closed-end funds that are intended to provide capital to small developing companies. They are not registered as investment companies under the Investment Company Act of 1940, but rather they elect to be treated as a BDC under the Investment Company Act of 1940. They can be publicly traded, non-publicly traded, or privately offered. And BDCs typically elect to be treated as a regulated investment company for tax purposes. So there's essentially no entity level tax on distributed income.
So a vehicle that has been around for a while, but maybe the popularity hasn't been there, and something Congress wanted to have as an alternative. But on the other side, part of the episode is the credit fund funds. So Colleen, what are we seeing there? I hear the term interval fund and tender option bond being bandied about. What does that actually mean?
The interval fund and tender offer funds really are each special types of closed-end registered investment products that, despite being closed-end, they allow for periodic redemptions or repurchases of their shares. Interval funds are required to offer repurchases at quarterly, semi-annual, or annual intervals, and are limited to redeem only a portion of their shares outstanding, which is generally between 5 and 25%. Tender option funds, on the other hand, are not obligated to repurchase their shares, but they may do so at the discretion of their board of directors. And the exposure to private credit that the interval funds and the tender offer funds gain is either by buying private debt or syndicated loans to small or middle market companies, or they may invest in traditional private credit funds that make these investments. Getting back to your point on credit fund of funds, that's where we see the credit fund of funds, where they're investing in the traditional private funds.
So we're seeing there on a mutual fund where the shareholders can demand at all times. There is liquidity in these products, but it's more periodic in the time-wise. If you have a public BDC, that's exchange, so shareholders can buy and sell on the exchange. On the private side, a lot more periodic intervals in when shareholder can get liquidity, but that option is still there for it. So what are some of the other things, Colleen, on that side, on the private credit?
The limitations on redemptions that interval funds and tender offer funds have really make them better suited for private credit than traditional open-end mutual funds that, as you say, have to facilitate daily redemptions on demand. Because the private credit investments themselves are not publicly traded, they're not highly liquid enough to be suitable for daily redemptions. A couple of other unique aspects of these funds are their ability to use leverage and their fee structures. These funds will generally utilize leverage to potentially increase their asset exposure. Interval and tender offer funds may have 300% asset coverage, and BDCs generally must maintain at least 200% asset coverage, but it can be reduced to 150% if certain conditions are met. These structures also offer different fee structures. So in addition to the general base management fee that's a percentage of assets, there can also be incentive fees. Interval and tender offer funds can charge incentive fees on income, but have limitations on charging incentive fees on capital gains or capital appreciation. Now, BDCs, on the other hand, can generally charge incentive fees based on net income as well as capital gains or capital appreciation. And these incentive fees may not be fully deductible for tax when they're deducted for GAAP. So that is something to watch for.
So it sounds like then that obviously the advisor would be interested because there's an ability to charge more fees there than there is in a normal open-ended fund structure. By the sound from both of you, a very regulated environment that these funds work in. So there seems to be a lot of differences when it comes to the regulated side of it, SEC side. But what does it mean from a tax side? We say in the title of the podcast, in a RIC wrapper, and that's from a tax perspective. So what tax refers to as a regulated investment company. So what does that mean, Sonia?
So a regulated investment company, which we refer to as RICs, is a domestic corporation that meets certain tax qualification requirements and is registered or has an election with the SEC under the Investment Company Act of 1940. RICs must also meet certain qualifications, such as passing a 90% annual gross income test, along with quarterly 50% and 25% asset diversification tests. And there's also a 90% annual distribution requirement. A qualifying RIC is not subject to U.S. federal income tax at the entity level. So unlike other corporate entities that we're used to, there's only one level of taxation at the shareholder level.
So similar to a partnership or a through pass-through entity, as long as they distribute all of their income in a certain time period, they get a deduction for that distribution. So there's no tax at that level. But isn't there a whole other regime or tax that a RIC can be subject to?
Yes, that is correct, Deirdre. I do want to mention there is an excise tax that was created to discourage RICs from delaying the payment of their deductible dividends beyond the calendar year in which the income was recognized. So that's something to consider here as well.
So something to be mindful of. It sounds like this vehicle has a lot of positives, and we've touched upon a lot of them there and why the popularity has occurred. So, Colleen, is there other items of benefits, or what's the catch here with this type of vehicle?
There's always a catch, isn't there?
Yeah.
Well, let me start off with some of the benefits. So as a regulated investment company or RIC, they act as corporations from a tax perspective. So as such, they can act as a natural blocker for foreign investors with respect to ECI and tax investors with respect to UBIT. So there's no need for special structures to be set up for those types of investors, which makes them very popular for gaining the assets from exempt and foreign investors. Another aspect that makes them popular is their simplified shareholder reporting. So from a RIC, they are going to distribute forms 1099 to their shareholders instead of a K-1 that investors would typically get in a private fund structure. 1099s tend to be simpler for investors to interpret, and they're generally available earlier, usually in January or February following year end, versus, you know, K-1s may come up to September following year end. Additionally, the state filing requirements for investors tend to be much less coming from a regulated investment company. Regulated investment companies also are a pass-through entity, similar to a partnership, sort of a quasi-pass-through entity, in that they can pass through the beneficial character of certain types of income. So qualified dividend income, long-term capital gains can be passed through, as well as for foreign investors, the interest-related component of their dividends and the short-term gain components can pass through, making the dividends paid from those sources not be subject to withholding for foreign investors. Another benefit with respect to these structures is that they provide a steady dividend stream. As Sonia had mentioned, regulated investment companies are required to pay 90% of their income. So all of the interest that they earn and net of their expenses will be paid out regularly to shareholders. And that can help provide the funds to the shareholders as well to pay the tax that they will inure on those dividends received. In a private credit fund structure, the earnings may not be distributed currently, yet the partners are taxed on their earnings during each year, which can include phantom income from original issue discount or payment in kind bonds that have no cash distributed as well associated with them. The funds are regulated under the Investment Company Act of 1940. And so that's where the rub comes in. It can be pro and a con, so higher cost to being subject to the regulatory rules, but it does allow for increased transparency to investors. And additionally, it requires that these funds have an independent board, and that provides additional governance feature. Just as far as cons as well, it's just the general qualification requirements that they have to play within those rules from the diversification and income qualification perspective.
An expensive vehicle to run and manage, whether it's a BDC or a regular credit fund of funds. But we've all been through the launch of these entities and what it really means, and as Colleen alluded to, and Sonia, you talked about briefly earlier, was the qualification requirements. There's asset diversification, so the assets need to be diversified, so there's not all eggs in one basket. And then the gross income has to be a certain type. So tell some of those limitations or how they have impacted these types of funds in launch.
So I briefly mentioned the asset diversification tests earlier, and there are some cures if those tests are not initially met, but those cures are not typically available during the first quarter of a RIC. If the fund is looking to qualify as a RIC, the assets, inclusive of any partnerships which will need to be looked through for asset diversification purposes, will need to be heavily monitored, especially in that first quarter, to make sure that the fund will be able to pass the 50% and the 25% diversification tests. Another thing to consider is what we touched on with that gross income. It's what type of income is being generated by the fund's assets. For example, if the income is more service fee related as opposed to interest income, or if the fund receives a Schedule K-1 with line one items, which are typically non-qualifying and need to be evaluated from a gross perspective, the fund may want to consider placing certain assets that could generate non-qualifying income for the 90% gross income test into blockers. The distributions from these blockers would be considered qualifying income for the 90% gross income test. So there are some planning strategies to implement there.
So how does one, people who might be interested in launching this type of fund, given the ramp up period is very short in the beginning, Colleen, what have we seen when it comes to that on the launching? How do we get that critical mass?
Often, you know, the private credit funds may be seeded with warehoused assets of the manager or from a seed investor of the manager, or they might be incubated as a private partnership before they're transferred into a regulated investment company structure. Now, depending on the source of the assets, the structuring can be quite complex. There will be considerations needed as to the taxability of the transfer to the private credit fund structure and whether that transfer qualifies as tax-free under Section 351, whether there is a trigger of market discount on the transfer, and whether the assets have a carryover basis on the transfer. If the assets have a net built-in loss at the time of the creation of the fund, a step down of the basis may be required, even in a tax-free transfer. And the allocation of that step down really depends on the type of transferor. There's various elections to consider as well that can be advantageous from a planning perspective. Additionally, it's important to consider if there's any corporate owners of any of the assets that are transferred to the fund. Even a corporate partner of any partnership in the chain of transfer needs to be identified. And this is because there's rules that seek to prevent the avoidance of the corporate double taxation with respect to any assets attributable to a corporate transferor. And that can result in a tax by the fund if there is net appreciation at the time of the transfer that is subsequently then recognized by the fund within 5 years. So you definitely want to be aware of that and be planning to the extent there could be an unexpected tax in a RIC structure. There are elections that are available as well to be planning for to potentially recognize that appreciation ahead of the transfer and incur the tax at that point.
Yeah. So vehicles popularity, definitely a hot topic at the moment. Planning upfront, making sure you get the structure right and knowing all of the pitfalls, really helpful. And any questions you have, thank you for joining us today with Talking Asset Management with KPMG and our series on private credit. Thanks, Sonia. Thanks, Colleen.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.